Hello and welcome to Gonservation Conversations, the show that loves a chat about wildlife, nature and conservation. Today, to discuss his love of the natural world, is the evergreen cartoonist, raconteur, lover of wildlife and a man who has been working tirelessly on behalf of those who suffer from dementia. It's time for me to welcome Tony Husband to Gonservation Conversations. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Gary. How are you doing, mate? Is it Gons with the Wind?
Gons with... Here we go. We're off into the pun zone straight away.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry. I want no more puns.
No? Oh, but that's why you're here, surely.
Okay, puns away.
Puns away. Absolutely. Rapunzel. You could be the new Rapunzel. Yeah. Oh, no. This is not going well.
No, it's a bad start. Shall we start again, Gary?
No, what the hell? Yeah, this is what we have to live with.
Yeah, this is us. This is what we are naturally.
It is. So, Tony, I thought it'd be great to chat to you because we've known each other quite some time now and we've shared a love of nature and wildlife and what have you. And I know you do a lot of work within that world and we'll talk about that through the programme. But I guess I want to find out... Really, how did it all start for you? Did you grow up in urban surroundings? Because I always think of you as being Mancunian and that you were an urban boy. Or did you actually grow up in the countryside and you're just fooling me?
I'm fooling you, Kerry, because basically I was born in Blackpool and at the age of five moved to Hyde near Manchester. Well, with my parents, of course. I didn't just, as a five-year-old, leave Blackpool with a suitcase and set up in Hyde. My parents moved to Hyde and we live on Wernith Low, which is a hill that overlooks Manchester. It's beautiful. It's kind of a spiritual place, I feel. And we lived over the back of Wernith Low on a beautifully named Apple Street. And we lived in a cottage. We had our own barn. That's where I grew up. And the woods were nearby. The hills and all, you know. So I spent lots of my life, early life, just running wild in the trees and the fields, playing football in the backfield, and then going into the woods where we were told not to go. And I've always been drawn to the woods. I just find something special in amongst trees. So yeah, I kind of very in touch with nature.
Were you aware as a child about the animals that surrounded you? Was it just the place and they were almost secondary? Or did you find that you had an affinity with animals from a very early age?
No, I always had an affinity. I mean, I've always had a dog. I've never not had a dog. And cats as well, you know, household pets. But we had a small holding at the cottage. My dad was... He worked for GUS mail order company, but we had like pigs, we had hens. As a child, I loved the pigs. I loved pigs, and me and my brothers used to feed them and look after them, and we became friends with them because they like dogs. They like, you know, they're a bright creature. But then we'd come home from school sometimes, and there'd be no pigs there, and they'd all been taken to the butchers, and it broke our hearts. So I kind of had this affinity with especially pigs for some reason, but well, because of that, I think. And I remember we had one pig called Sally, a huge sow, and she used to breed all these little piglets and we'd be up all night with them and looking after them. And then, you know, if she had too many, we'd have to hand feed them, you know, milk with some milk. And then I remember coming home and then we always went straight to see Sally and went into the barn where she was and the stall was empty. And I went back, I said, "Mum, where's Sally?" And she was crying. And I said, "Oh, you can't take Sally." And it just broke my heart. So, yeah, I kind of have this love of animals and also, you know, the wild animals that were around, the foxes, there's always foxes and badgers. The bird life was amazing up there, you know, sort of going into the woods, you'd hear the birds. I remember once taking my dog, I had a dog called Gollum in my old hippie days, and I remember taking Gollum down into the woods and it was absolutely raining, bombing it down, and it was really quiet. And then when the rain stopped and the sun came out, suddenly the whole woods burst into song. All these birds, like, started singing, and it was so loud, the dog started barking at the woods. And I'll always remember that, and it was one of the most moving things I've ever heard. All these, you know, the life and the vitality of the birds and the beautiful songs, all like a big crescendo of sound. And even freak the dog out.
I remember growing up, even in London, that you would have a Dawn chorus that was big and it was huge and it was a monumental sound. And I just remember in summer, you'd be woken up by the sound of all the birds in the gardens and what have you. And for where you were as a kid, the sound must have been immense. Have you noticed how different that's become over the years, and that actually the Dawn chorus is a much smaller event?
Yeah, it is. But where I live, Kerry, I'm still live on top of Wernerflow. So I've got a big garden that leads right down to the fields. So there's still a lot of bird life around here. I can't sort of say whether it's bigger or not, because my childhood was a long time ago, I'm afraid. But I'm surrounded by it still. And, you know, you hear the blackbirds and you hear the robins and all the finches singing. And then you hear the crows nattering away. And then what I love is the sound of all the sparrows, because they land in a tree. They love one of the trees here. And they'll all arrive and start, God knows what they're talking about, but they're all nattering away to each other. So I feel as though it's kind of followed me everywhere, mate. And I don't feel that loss, but I realise there is a loss, not only with the birds, but with other creatures that used to thrive, you know, the hedgehog as well. I've not seen a hedgehog for ages. So, yeah, there is a difference without any question.
There seems to be a generation of younger people who are way more focused on the environment than perhaps some of the previous generations.
I think they are, and I think children are very bright, and they can see what we've settled for isn't good. And you get Greta, the young Swedish girl, I think she is, who's done incredible things and raised awareness. I know my granddaughters, the schools are teaching them about the environment and about the damage done, and so they're learning at school now, whereas we didn't. We didn't see the problem now, but I think the children are saying, look, you lot, you know, you're going to destroy this for us unless you do something pretty quick, and time is running out. So I don't want my grandchildren, Daisy's six, I don't want her growing up in the wilderness of, you know, poison and extinct animals. That would be awful.
The fact that you were brought up around animals all the time, you had wildlife in the woods, you went for walks everywhere. When you started drawing, did you draw animals? And what started you drawing?
I think drawing was always a natural thing for me to do. I kind of started doodling. I did like pen matchstick men. And I wanted to be an artist. My dream as a kid when I was in bed was to imagine myself having a cottage and being a painter or an artist. I didn't think of a cartoonist at the time, but because I didn't really know anything about cartoons. I'd always loved drawing. I was always the best in the class at drawing and the best in the class at secondary school at art, and always creative. As in my English class, I always wrote the best essays and the best stories, short stories. My imagination was very fertile. It was basically when I started to draw, I tried to get working in a textile design company, but my dad wouldn't let me go to art college. He just said, no, you've got to get a proper job. That was a friction thing, because he let my brother go to be a painter and decorator to learn how to do that at college, but he wouldn't let me go to art college to learn to be a designer or whatever it would have been. And in a way, I always wanted, I'm going to show you that, you know, to prove him wrong, that he shouldn't have done that. He should have let me have my wish and go to college. But in a way, I'm kind of glad it didn't, because it gives me this freedom that I'm not taught anything. It's all self-taught. It's all natural. When I was drawing, I realised that, you know, I wasn't that great an artist. But once I started drawing cartoons, I was a natural cartoonist. And that came about when my first job was in advertising. And they used to have Punch in their reception. So I'd just take it at lunchtime and read it and look at the cartoons and think, wow. And my dad had done some cartoons and tried to sell them, and I'd seen those, and they weren't great, but I just kind of thought, this is what I want to do, you know, this is what I want to do.
So what was it that drew you to cartoons? Is it because of your sense of humour? I presume you were a funny guy back then as well as now. Was there something that allowed you to make comments? Because the purpose of cartoons is often to point out the injustices of the world, to have a satirical look at the world. What drew you to that?
My cartoons are basically about life. I do political cartoons, and I do like to make points and get my voice out that way. But if you look at my cartoons, they're kind of about people, about people's relationships, about husband and wife, children and place at work, or even the pets and the owners, your dog and cats. Most of my cartoons, as they developed, were about people and about situations and about life. And somewhere inside me, I must observe it. I was quite a shy kid at school. I think being in the countryside, living where we did, were totally isolated. So I grew up with my younger brothers and then the farmer's kids down the road. So I wasn't streetwise anyway. I discovered music early on, and music's been my passion. The Stones were my first band. My first gig was the Stones and Ike and Tina Turner in 1966. And the second gig was Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd in 1967. So the music and the flair of the music, and then my imagination, and it's all kind of all rolled into one about an energy. And I had this energy for drawing cartoons, and it started with hippie magazines because they had the same principles as I did. I didn't get money for them. I just, when they got albums to review, they would give me the albums for the cartoons. And it was like, there's a magazine called Mole Express, M-O-L-E, and Grass Eye, which were the two Manchester magazines I drew for. So I kind of slowly evolved into being a cartoonist and looking at other cartoonists and seeing how they did it. And I became passionate about it, really.
Were there any particular cartoonists that you looked up to, that you respected, that you were influenced by? Or did you end up finding your own voice within the middle of it?
A bit of both, really. I mean, I love Mike Williams, a Liverpool cartoonist. Bill Tidy, again, from Liverpool. There's a French guy called Sempe. There was Fawkes, who was a great cartoonist. And it was the Punch cartoonist. And then there's a guy called Pont, P-O-N-T, who died when he was 30, he had TB. And he died just before the Second World War, at the start of the Second World War. But if you look at Pont's drawings, he draws the British way of life. And I won an award, it's called the Pont Award, for showing the British way of life, the best for showing the British way of life. And Pont was one of my inspirations. So I was being influenced by these people. I wrote to Bill Tidy and asked him how to be a cartoonist. He sent me an amazing letter back. I wrote to Ray Lowry, the rock and roll cartoonist, and Ray sent me a really nice letter back, just encouraging me and just said, do your own thing, don't copy, don't follow, look for unusual angles. And that's kind of what I did, because I've got an unusual mind, as you know, Kerry, a bit dark as well, which is good. I love the dark side. So, and that helps you. You know, so I think you can draw anything. I wouldn't draw everything. There are things I won't draw, but I don't think there should be a ban on people drawing anything if they want to draw it.
What draws you to the normal, really? Because actually, by drawing the normal, you kind of make it extraordinary in its own way. The ordinary becomes extraordinary.
Well, I think the ordinary is, what people do in their lives is quite surreal when you actually separate it from once you look at it closely and you look at the way people are and how they are with the dogs and how they are with the cats, and you know how, and you can put yourself in the mind of a cat looking at its owner or the dog looking at its owner, and you know, if you can think what the dog's thinking, and it's just I get these surreal thoughts, and life is surreal. People are weird and quirky and funny without them knowing it. You know, and that it's like you listen to Alan Bennett talking. You know, you realise what he sees as well. I remember there's one thing he said. My mum rang when she said, "Can you come round the tortoises playing up?" And you know, it's things like that that are just lovely sort of throwaway comments, but are just funny. And it's the simple things, just the little things that are funny, I find.
Do you ever stop looking at people? Are you one of these people who's always got a sketchbook in your pocket? Can you just not stop yourself? Because it's almost like an involuntary reaction to the world sometimes.
I think my mind works all the time, definitely, because I can wake up in the middle of the night and have an idea. Sometimes I'm so tired, I think, oh, I'll remember it in the morning, and then frustratingly, I don't. Sometimes I started writing poems in the lockdown about dementia and other things. I wrote one about Hyde, my town, which is, you know, going downhill like a lot of small northern towns. And I just woke up in the middle of the night with a few lines from this poem and started to write it. And I put it on Facebook and it's had about 400 likes or something. And people saying, oh, that's Hyde now. So I got, you know, so it's kind of prolific. It doesn't stop. Someone said, where do you get your ideas from? And I don't know. I remember reading about Neil Young and someone saying, there's a huge lake of ideas out there. And if you can find the tap to it, then you're okay. And Neil Young's done that. And I think I have. I kind of look for the doors, open the doors and go through and see what's on the other side. And it's kind of an adventure. And I love the fact that what I do is so different and varied. I'd hate to do the same thing all the time. So I'm always looking for new things to do and new things, people to work with, you know, and all sorts, you know. So it's kind of an ongoing creative process that I can't stop. It's like a river and it just keeps going. So I'm not going to dam it up. I'm just going to let it flow.
Would you say that actually, because a lot of the time, cartoonists can be solitary creatures while they're watching the world and seeing everything go by, that actually collaboration gives you a lift and a tonic in a special kind of way. And how does that feel for you when you get to share your ideas?
Well, it's great, because you're right. I mean, most of my time I'm sat in my studio now, I'm looking down the garden, I've got my dog at my feet, I've got my optics. No, I don't. There was a cartoonist, actually. It was Jack, the cartoonist. And when I went to his studio once in London in Fleet Street, and those were, he'd got some optics behind his desk, so he'd just be drawing and then go behind him with a glass and pour a large whiskey. No, I kind of I love working on my own, and I'm doing that now. I've been working on a new project. But then, like, with Oink, the comic that we created in the late 80s, that was with Mark and Patrick, who we got to know each other. We all wrote for the children's comics. We're all based in Manchester. We bumped into each other. We said, let's create our own comic. We knew the editors down at IPC. And Bob Painter, and we just said, Bob, we'd like to do our own comic. And then we got all these wonderful cartoonists involved I knew, who weren't comic artists mainly, who it was all fresh to. So Oink came out, and it was like a really fresh comic. We wrote music for it. It was a music-based comic. Me and Mark Riley, as you know, a friend of ours, Mark Rogers and I did a song each, and Mark did the music, and Mark played the instruments and sang on them. Then John Peel played them on his show. So that was great, working with, and we got Mark involved, Mark, and that was 1985, 86, and, you know, me and Mark have been friends ever since then. And then working with all the artists, and then we did Round the Bend for television, which was a big success, and people still send us messages saying, where's a DVD of Round the Bend? It was the best thing ever. And I worked with a guy called Ian McMillan, the poet. Me and Ian have toured the country for 20-odd years doing our cartoon and poetry show. You know, we do village halls, where we create a poem with the audience, and as Ian's working the poem out from the audience, I'm drawing it on flip charts, and you've got to be really sharp to do it, because Ian will start the show with, it was midnight at Allington Village Hall, midnight at Allington Village Hall, what will you see outside the Village Hall? And people shout out, oh, a ghost, or, anything. The very first one we did, we were all new to it, so we didn't know what to expect, and Ian said, what will you see outside Allington Village Hall? And someone said, nothing. And Ian said, no, because he can work with that. And I can't, I've got to draw, I can't draw nothing. So Ian's going, yeah, that's a good one. You see nothing. I'm going, Ian, I can't draw nothing. And then he realised that and said, oh, what else besides nothing will you see? And then someone said, oh, the ghost of Ben the donkey, the village donkey who died recently. So then we started drawing about the village donkey, and it kind of grew into this wonderful epic poem. And it was all spontaneous with the audience. So it's this, like, flow of creativity. And the audience got creative. Ian's incredibly creative and funny, and he sees everything so he can bring things in. And it's just a real trip, and it's just fun. And the audience loved it. You know, we just got so many, you know, nice comments about it. So working with people is great, but then coming back to the solitude of just me and my pen and a piece of paper and my head, just whatever comes out of my head, and then try and sell it, no matter what's going on in my life. That's the challenge, but it's a challenge I love. And the other thing, I love deadlines, because I worked for the Times for 25 years doing the daily sports cartoons, so I was doing 6 cartoons a week. And then on Sunday, I did one for the Sunday Express sports page. So what happens there is, at 4 o'clock, the Times would ring me with the story of the day. It could be about football, golf, tennis, anything that's breaking. And then by 5 o'clock, I would have sent them 4 ideas, 4 roughs on an A4 piece of paper, squared it off. They would then choose one, and I would draw it up. So within an hour, they'd have had 4 cartoons. They would have okayed one, and then it would be in the paper next day. And that was wherever I wasn't, you know. So if I was on tour with Ian, I'd be looking for fax machines in those days. In the village, I kind of nip to your house and use the fax to send to the Times. So it's this it's just there in me that it just happens. It's like, I don't know how or why, but it does, and it's good. But yeah, working with people is fabulous. I've worked with Stephen Fry, I've worked with Griff Rhys-Jones, people like that. I've, you know, all sorts of things. I've worked with bands, I've worked with British Sea Power, and just lots of great, fun things with great people. And it's always a gas, it's always just a trip. And then I can come back to my house, my garden, take my dog for a walk, sit down at my desk, and then create, either draw, I've started drawing properly, drawing animals, which I think I sent you some, Kerry, and then are creating new ideas, and working on a book about dementia with a dementia carer, dementia activist at the moment, called Gina, and we're doing a book about carers in the dementia world, people who look after people living with dementia. So so that's my latest project.
I was just going to talk about your book that you released in, I think it was 2014, which was called Take Care, Son, The Story of My Dad and His Dementia. What drew you to such a subject? Is this actually just a continuation of you portraying normal people with normal situations and normal or abnormal problems, that actually it made sense for your style of art to lend itself to this book?
Well, what happened there was my dad had had dementia and he'd passed away. And about 6 months later, I'm sat in my studio at the end of the day. I'd got a bottle of Rioja and I'm just sat there and, you know, having a drink, and I got some music on. I just said to my dad, "Daddy had dementia. What was it like to have dementia? Do you remember?" And it just came out of my mouth, and he just, his voice came to me and just said, "Well, I had dementia and you're asking me to remember." And he kind of laughed. And I thought, wow. So I started talking. We had this conversation, me and my dad, about what it was like to have dementia. At the beginning, how it started, some of the incidents, like when he went into hide in his pyjamas, pyjama bottoms, he didn't put his trousers on. And then at the end where he says, "Can you imagine what it's like to lose memory of everything and everyone you've ever loved? Can anything be so cruel?" And when I looked, I'd been drawing these, I'd drawn three A4 pages of these ideas, of this talk, you know, like a little storyboard. I didn't know what to do with it. I went to the Groucho Club and showed people there, and they were all saying, "Oh, this is, you know, this could be fabulous. This is, could be so important." And I showed Stephen Fry. Stephen's a friend, and I said, "You know, Stephen, I've got this because I know he was involved in mental health. He was chairman of Mind and lots of other things." And he just came back to me. I sent him the three pages, and he came back and said, "Tony, I'm in tears. Can I tweet them?" And I said, "Yeah, of course you can." He said, "Can your system take up to 11 million hits?" And I said, "I don't know, Stephen, but we'll see." Anyway, he tweeted it. It did obviously go big. And then a publisher emailed me and said, "We saw your cartoons. Do you want to do a book about your dad's dementia?" And I spoke to my brothers, because obviously it's their dad as well, and they all said, "Yeah, we know how you'll be." That's how that came out. And it was just a little book, 60 pages, of me chronicling my dad's life in dementia. So it was, and the family, and, you know, how we all cope with it. And it was quite therapeutic as well. But what the wonderful thing is that it has helped so many people. And if you go on Amazon and look at the comments from people who've had it, and they're very moving. And I know I'm now working a lot in the dementia world, raising awareness, and for universities, for care homes, and it's making a difference. It is helping to raise awareness of the illness.
Is humour an important way to get messages across? Because we can all be told terrible things, but if you can do it with a twist of humour, I'm not saying it makes it more palatable, but I think it makes people more thoughtful. They don't walk away from dark subjects so much.
No, I totally agree. It doesn't scare people. So if you can have a laugh, and you do, you'd laugh. I think most people who are in family situations will have a laugh at whatever the situation is. It's how you get through it. And humour is. I take my book around the country doing a PowerPoint talk, and it makes people laugh and cry. You know, it makes, like when my dad called me up one day to the house and the cottage. He lives just over the back of where I live. He said, "You've got to come round and see this. They're everywhere." I said, "Oh, Dad." He said, "Aliens, of course, aliens." So it was dark. I went over, and he's in the back room. He said, "I'm sending them messages." So I said, "How?" He said, "Well, Morse code," because he was in the signals unit in the army. And so he said, oh, he has one. And it was, come in for a cup of tea. Welcome to our planet. I said, Dad, what the hell are you doing? He said, no, they're aliens. You can see them flying around. And when I went to look, it was across the valley. There was two villages and there's a road between the two villages. And it was car headlights. And every time a car headlight went past, he thought it was a spaceship flying around. So he was inviting them in for cups of tea. So that he kind of... And when I spoke to my dad about that, you know, he laughed. He said, oh, God, you know, what am I like? Blah, blah, blah. But it was a fun... And then, but then the sad side of it, where when he went to the care home and he got his little dog, Lossie, a Westie, who he absolutely adored and wouldn't let out of the house. He was so frightened. And then so you go... I'm taking him to the care home, saying, Dad, say bye to your cottage. He'd lived in for 50-odd years where my mum had died and all that. And he got Lossie on his knee and he said, where are we going? And I said, we're going on holiday, Dad. And it was like a respite idea. And if he liked the care home, he'd stay in. If he didn't, we could bring him out. So we got to the care home and then he kind of just... We got inside and he said, well, this is nice. And I said, yeah, but I've got to take Lossie, Dad. And Lossie can't stay here with you. And I've never seen anybody so anguished, and he was crying and trying to grab Lossie. The lady said, take, go on, please go. And I took Lossie out of the care home, and I sat in the car, sobbed my heart out with Lossie on my knee. Lossie was great. Lossie stayed with us and had a good life. But so you could tell those two stories in the same book to show the extremes of the effects of dementia. And it can be funny, it can be heartbreaking, but the both stories are there to be heard.
Having lived through it, would you say that writing the book taught you more about dementia, or did it make you hone your thinking about dementia? What did it do for you, writing that book?
Well, it brought me into the dementia world, and I did. I've learned a hell of a lot more, and I've now worked in people living with dementia, creating things. I've worked in care homes, and I've learned so much about how you speak with people with dementia, how you treat them, how they, you know, how you should give them respect, and how they do like to laugh. You know, I worked with Lancaster University on a thing, and it was like the top 10 things people with dementia would like, and in the top 5 was they like to laugh. Don't treat us with, you know, kid gloves. We still want to laugh. So you do. You have a laugh. You take the piss a bit. You know, it's all part of the journey. I've learned a lot how to, you know, you don't contradict someone with dementia. If they say something ludicrous, you don't say, oh, no, that's not true. That can't happen. You go, all right, that's interesting. Because they don't understand. They'll just get confused and, you know, anxious if you question them or if you contradict them. So you go along with that because you can't change anything. But then you can have these amazing, surreal conversations. Like I had with my dad once when he said, oh, I came round and he was like fuming. I said, what's the matter, Dad? He said, I'm on the front page of the Daily Express today. I said, why? He said, about bringing these boxes into the country. So I said, oh, right. He said, can you ring the editor, because I work for the Express, and tell him to take me off the front page? It's nothing to do with me. So I said, well, I can do, Dad, but I've got to tell him who it is, who's bringing the box in. He said, well, it's the bloody Americans, isn't it? So I said, well, the Americans are doing it. So he said, yeah. I said, what's in them? He said, Tony, he said, Americans, guns. And I said, oh, right. So then I pretended to ring the editor of the Express. And my dad said, can I have a word with him? And then I thought, oh, shit. So it was like, well, he's busy, Dad, he can't speak to you. No, I want a word with him. And I'd ask him why he's... So... eventually. But there's another funny thing with Mark Riley, actually. I went up to sit with Dad one night, and Mark's show was on, his Radio 6 show, and he's playing this music, and Lossie, my dad's dog, started rolling on his back, scratching the back, you know, scratching his back like dogs do. And my dad laughed. He said, oh, Lossie's dancing to this music. So I text Mark and I said, hi, Mark. I sat with my dad and his dog, and he thinks the dog's dancing to this music, but it's scratching his back. So when the song finished, I'm sat there with my dad, and Mark comes on and says, right, that was for Tony, his dad, and his dog, Lossie, who's dancing to the music. And my dad went, they're listening in. They got cameras. And he started going around the house looking for cameras. And I thought, oh, shit. So you know, you do have things do backfire, but you can also have a laugh, and you should do. There's also the tragic side of it as the dementia worsens. And then people forget how to eat. They can't swallow. They don't know. My dad used to try and eat, and then he'd try and tear the food out of his mouth because he didn't know what it was. He didn't know he had to chew it. And then the nurses are saying, no, chew, Ron, and doing choreographing the, you know, the movements of chewing, ripping the food out of his mouth, panicking. So those are things you don't want to see. But those are things, that's where the illness takes you eventually.
You just mentioned Lossie again. One thing that I wanted to talk to you about is the power of nature and the power of wildlife, the power of animals, the power of the natural world around us for those who suffer from dementia, because there is something in that, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely, sir. And the other thing, Kerry, is the word suffer is now, the people in dementia world don't say people who suffer with dementia, it's live with dementia. So kind of that word suffering now is not used in dementia world. But animals, my dad, you took Lossie into the care home. Everybody was laughing and, you know, trying to sort of stroke Lossie. And going for walks, going in the gardens are very important, the smells of nature, the sounds of nature. A lot of care homes now have got special dementia gardens that are full of smells and memories and, you know, that people can sit and listen and the bird life, they introduce birds, bird life and all sorts of into dementia homes now. You know, just because they realise the importance of nature, as is the importance of music for those living with dementia. And I've been, when my dad, going for a walk with my dad on top of the low with Lossie, and he was looking at everything, listening, he was like tuned into it. He wasn't tuned into anything else but what was going on around him. It was like he was at one with it. And I did notice that quite often with him and other people I've known since who have dementia.
You've worked with various conservationists, and you also know the founders of the EIA, the Environmental Investigation Agency.
Yeah, Jenny and Alan. This was through a friend of mine, David Day, who was, is a Canadian writer. And I met David through Terry Jones, the python Terry, who ended up with dementia. And David knew Alan. They were the long-term friends from Canada. And so I got to know Alan, and then I got to know Jenny. I've not spoken to Alan for a long time, but I'm still in touch with Jenny. So, yes, I've been involved with the EIA for a long time now. And, I'm kind of passionate about it. And so many you can get overwhelmed by all the things, you know, like the shark fin soup trade and, you know, the bear baiting and, you know, the dancing bears and the elephant ivory. You kind of got to concentrate on one thing, I think, really, or a few things, because if you spread yourself too thin. I did a video for the EIA. They did a tiger awareness campaign about the plight of the tiger. And I did it with a friend of mine, Sean Taylor, who's a musician, and a poet, Dan Cockerell, who lives in London. And we did it, I filmed it like the Bob Dylan Subterranean Homesick Blues video, where Bob's in an alleyway and Allen Ginsberg's in the back with another poet. And Bob's got all these lyrics on the cards. You've probably seen the video, it's famous. But we've done the same thing with our song, and it was Imagine a Tiger. And Dan's reading the poem, and Sean's playing the music, and I'm in this alleyway with my cartoons and dropping them on the floor as the poem develops. And it's quite beautiful. Then we did a little gig for them somewhere in London, which was well attended. We got a few, Steve Fretwell, his band came, and we had a few poets and other musicians turning up for free to raise awareness. So I did a book with David Day about the rhinoceros. David is an environmental writer, David Day. I did a book with him. David did this. It was called a book called Eco Wars, and it was all about how people are using ecology and the environment against each other, you know. And there's something like where they tie in bombs to dolphins and they can go in and blow ships up and stuff like that. And so David and I did a series for Punch magazine based on his book. I illustrated David's stories about the various...
That was the A to Z of the environment, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. But it came from David's book, Eco Wars. If you Google David Day, he's got a number of books out about that. And as has Alan Thornton. I've got a lovely book by Alan about elephants, and he's signed it to me with a lovely message about you know, tracking down the elephant hunters and the poachers. So yeah, I'm still involved with them. I still, you know, I'm always there for them if they would need me to relate any cartoon, where, you know, using the cartoon format to raise awareness. Yeah, I'm up for that too, all the time.
Yeah, and just to say that the EIA is the Environmental Investigation Agency. Their main remit is the illegal wildlife trade that goes on. And if anyone wants to go and see their work, you can check in at EIA.org. They are a fantastic group. What shocks me in this world is there are all these incredible charitable conservation bodies in place, all trying to raise money for their respective projects. Do you think we're in need of a world shakedown and understand that many of the issues should be faced by governments and not depend on charity and citizen science almost?
Absolutely, I think. But that's across the board. It's like the book I'm doing about carers for those living with dementia. And it's basically the government are using the carers as cheap labour. Because if, you know, if there was no carers there, they'd have to have nurses to look after people. So, and it's the same with the environment. They are relying on charities to do the dirty work for them. But they're still doing business with countries and who do illegal things, and they don't clamp down on, you know, they do it sort of as a gesture, but they don't do it as, they don't mean it somehow. You never get the feeling that governments actually mean what they say when they talk about the environment, how they are going to change everything, and you kind of don't think they are. It's just wordplay just to keep us quiet so that we think they're doing what they're doing, but actually they're not. There's still the forests being still chopped down, I hate the thought that the part of the Amazon every so many minutes, the size of a football field, is being destroyed. But that's allowed, and the governments can see it. They're not, you know, they know what's going on. Yeah, there's all sorts of corruption as well at that level in all over the world. And there's bad people. I mean, I know the shark fin soup trade, it's run by a Chinese gangster or something.
But all of these trades are invariably run by gangsters, because it's a multi-billion dollar industry. It's like there are so many animals that are in major danger. Look at all the Chinese market for all the medicines that they use out of animals, you know, pangolin scales. You know, and it's all based on nonsense, all of it.
It's folklore.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a Vietnamese minister said that he had cancer and he survived cancer and he's in recovery because he'd ingested rhino horn powder. And that, so they're all thinking, oh, that's, we've got cancer, where do we get rhino horn powder? So that was a big thing. And it's a huge battle because there's so many powerful organisations and people and gangsters and, you know, like the guy from EIA who was going to go to Borneo, and they knew where he lived and they knew he had family. They named his family. And they said, you know, you go there, you know, you won't see your family.
In Malta, I did an interview with somebody who I can't name about the illegal hunting of migratory bird species.
Oh, God, yeah.
And we did an interview, and he showed me information about what had been shot over the last number of years. And then I got a call after the interview had finished and said, look, please, you cannot release that. I've had my family and my home threatened, and they really will carry out this because it's criminal activity everywhere.
I also don't think the word hunting is, because all they do is stand on a hill, if I'm right, you know better than me, Kerry, but don't they just shoot birds as they're going overhead?
Yeah, absolutely. And
so it's not hunting, it's target practice.
Yeah.
They could do the same thing with clay pigeons. It's the same effect, but they don't. They want to kill live animals. You see it with these hideous people who see themselves sat on rhinoceroses and giraffes. And I mean, you shoot a giraffe and you call that hunting. So you get all, you know, these companies that promote what the safari, you know, and it's hunting safari, wild game hunting.
It's crazy. All right, well, we should talk on the slightly more upside of things. Is there any particular species that you've seen in the wild that you've just been blown away by? Or any particular species you want to see?
Oh, God, there's loads I'd love to see. I mean, when the wild scene, so many places in zoos and safari parks, I've not that well travelled. I mean, I love seeing what I really do love, and here every night, two badgers come up the garden, they've made a little path, and they stick to the path, and every night I feed them. And these two badgers come every night and quite happily sit outside the living room window, scoffing the food I've left for them. And that, to me, is an absolute joy. And then followed by the fox, or the fox will get there first. There's a bit of a race to see who gets the food first. And this beautiful fox will just come and he looks in. And I remember we had a pheasant that used to come up the garden and just tap on the window. And you're like, oh, God, he's here again. So you'd have to go and feed him. I did a cartoon showing a couple having the dinner and outside in the garden on the washing line, on the bird feeder, on the windowsill is hundreds and hundreds of birds looking in. And the lady's saying, haven't you fed the birds today? And that's what it's like. You know, the birds actually come now. So I kind of love the local. The badgers, to me, are my favourite. I just love the badgers. One came in the house once. I sat in the back room, in my music room, as I call it, and they got a conservatory. So the French windows were opening to the conservatory. And suddenly I saw this, I'm drawing, and it's a badger's coming, and he kind of looks at me and then goes out. And it's like he's just come in and said, excuse me, there's no food out here. What's going on? So I got up, got some food and put it out for him. And then he came back and scoffed it all. So,
but doesn't this show the sentience of these creatures? They're intelligent, they're thoughtful, they understand your role in their life. There's a connection that happens between us and wildlife that so many people have forgotten about or have never even found out about it.
Exactly, and that's sad. If there's a connection between humans and animals. Oh, we're animals, you know, we are animals. So we're all connected. And you can see a field full of cows, sheep, horses, all happily together. You can see birds flocking amongst them. And I saw some on during the fires in Australia, there was one subgroup of cyclists going through, and then this little kangaroo hops out. They stop for drinks, and this kangaroo hops out and hops up to them, and they realise that it wants water. So this guy gets his bottle of water, and the kangaroo comes up, and he just pours water down its mouth. And the kangaroo knew that the people would have water, and it was so sad and so beautiful. And the fact that the people knew and were kind enough to, you know, see what the kangaroo needed. And, you know, so there is that bond, and we shouldn't lose it. There are people who enjoy killing animals. I'm not one of them. I don't eat. I'm a vegetarian. I've not always been a vegetarian, but I'm happy that I am. Really am. I don't eat fish. I don't eat any meats at all. I don't feel superior. I just feel more comfortable with my life, with not eating those things.
Yeah, I understand that. And so would you say, I mean, your talk about the badgers and the foxes, this also just throws up one last thought, is that local conservation and being involved locally with the world around you is as important as saving tigers and lions and all these other creatures across the world. Yes, they need our support, but there's so much that we have to do here that is important to do, and to really understand that local conservation is a huge issue as well. And we can all do something, even if it's just adding a few extra plants that bees can pollinate.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, bees and moths, as we've read about, we're 30% down on moths at the moment in this country because of the habitats being destroyed. I know that's worldwide with all animals. We're taking over everything, and they kind of just, there's little pockets of places where these beautiful creatures can live. But yeah, locally, and this is where children can be absolutely fabulous. With something like insects and right down to the tiniest little creatures, we can all make it easier for them. I've got a big garden, I'm lucky, but the bottom quarter is all wild, and I'm just leaving it like that. So the animals, I've got a pile of wood in the corner there, and God knows what's underneath it. I really hope there's a hedgehog there, because, like I said, I've not even seen hedgehogs as roadkill recently. So I think there's, you know, I mean, that was always a sad sight, but I've not even seen that, so I presume they're on the decline. I've not seen rabbits. I saw a couple of rabbits when I took the dog for a walk over the back recently, and I've not seen rabbits for a long time. There used to be loads of rabbits in the bottom of the garden. Every morning you'd see them playing, and I've not seen any for ages. So there's something bad going on.
That's for certain. That's for certain. But all right, well, look, we're just about out of time now. Thank you, Tony. You've been fantastic. It has just been a brilliant chat with you. So, Tony Husband, you are a conservationist. Conservation Conversations is presented by me, Kerry Levy. Our series editor is Leon Rachinsky-Gorman. Our producer is Jackie Anklin. Our executive producers are Ralph Steadman and Sadie Williams. Our series consultant producer is Gary Hayes. Music by Leon Rachinsky-Gorman, lyrics by me. Find out more about conservation and conservation conversations at conservation.com and on Instagram and Twitter at conservation. Conservation Conversations is produced as part of the Highway 61 network, supporting independent producers. For more information and podcasts like this one, visit highway61.media or highway61_podcasts on Instagram and Twitter.